Welcome back to the Tell It Like It Is podcast, where leading female founders, industry trailblazers, and all-around badass women tell it like it really is. I'm your host, Cassandra Ray. Joining me today is Verity Tuck, co-founder and COO of the Australian e-commerce company Lovely, that's spelled L-V-L-Y. Described as the Uber of the gift-giving world, Lovely has been one of the few companies who have thrived through the coronavirus lockdown, with sales up by over 320%, which is staggering. In 2018, Lovely were selected as one of only 8 Australian companies to participate in the Silicon Valley-backed Springboard Accelerator for female-led transformative enterprises. Prior to launching Lovely, Verity spent over 10 years working in advertising, including serving as a group account director for Isobar, one of Australia's largest digital agencies. Verity, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
So I in that lead up, that was quite impressive, 320% growth during coronavirus lockdown. I can imagine you've been working day and night with that kind of growth. How are you doing?
Yes, it's come through. I guess it's pretty luck, a bit by chance that it happened that way. We were actually forced into, just before coronavirus hit, we were forced into moving premises in Melbourne, and a few other little things happened that we were, you know, seemed to be making the business potentially not go in the direction we wanted. And then this virus hit, and we, like most businesses, had that moment where we thought we might have to stand down staff, and we had emails ready to go to let them know that, you know, we may not be able to continue. And it was that knife edge that it just completely changed and went straight up. And I think it was based on exactly why we're here, which is trying to connect people and bringing that joy to every day, which is making people smile more often. And I guess in circumstances like this, it was even more relevant to be able to reach out and tell people that you were thinking of them when you were missing their birthday and things like that. So out of the blue, we just, hit the next level, and we had to hit the ground running in a new office space and had to completely redefine operations in Melbourne and Sydney in particular. It was 7-day-a-week job, many hours a day. My poor husband had to take the brunt of 2 young children. So I'm very grateful that he was able to work from home a bit. It was pretty exhausting. But, you know, at the same time, we were and are still so grateful for the, you know, in times like this when a lot of people are losing their jobs, to actually be able to create jobs as well for lots of Melburnians and Sydney-siders.
How many new people did you hire in this period?
I think it was about close to 35 in Melbourne and about 18 to 20 in Sydney.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was next level.
Yeah, let's go there now, and then I'll come back. So one of the things that I wanted to ask about specifically, which is I've never asked a guest about this before, because normally company values are, you know, quite bland. They feel like they've been written by HR bots. but, you know, yours really struck me when I was doing research for this call. I mean, it just felt so human and so spot on. So just for the benefit of our audience, I'm going to read through them very, very quickly. We're a bunch of people driven by purpose and passion. Make someone's day. One team, one dream. Work hungry, hustle hard. I love that. Own your impact. And then my personal favorite, be a goodie. So I want to get into how you came up with these and you know, how they present themselves in your day-to-day. But given the scale and speed with which you needed to hire in this particular time, how do you in general hire against these values? How do you test people in the interview process against these values? And also specifically when you had to scale up the team so quickly, how do you hire people against these values?
I think on a day-to-day basis, we hire with attitude and aptitude in mind more than a CV and experience. I guess coming from a startup point of view, you look for things that you can't quite read through a CV. So, you know, a bit of gusto, a bit of, you know, a glint in someone's eye, the way they explain how things mean to them, the energy in the room, things you can't feel, see or touch in a CV, we read within an interview. And that is so, I've always felt energy wise, you just kind of know. And if you're, you know, if you're close with your intuition and you rely on it in your day-to-day life, which I hope we all do, just making sure that you're tuned in with yours makes you trust yours, and you can see whether the person sitting in the room is the right fit. So that's how we do it a lot of times. Obviously, you know, you kind of do the other sound checks of whether, you know, they have a bit of knowledge here or there where you need it. But especially in the kind of environment we're in, where it's a small team, we do need them to hustle hard and be in this together. So they have to know a bit about everything and drop everything to be able to help over here if they have to. It's really important that they have the right X factor, I guess, just a bit of passion, a bit of drive, a bit of, you know, something that you can't really put through on a CV. So that's how we tend to do it. We've just, I don't know if luck's the right word, because we've had incredible luck with our hires, but I think it's because we do really pay homage to these values and hiring by them. And when I must say, the last, in terms of scaling quickly, it was really tricky. We put out an online questionnaire, or like an online, yeah, I guess questionnaire, when things skyrocketed, saying, does anyone want to work? And can you fill out this questionnaire? So we had about 900 applicants within the space of 24 hours to work in our Melbourne and Sydney offices, which was incredible, like to be able to choose from such a list of people so quickly. But I don't know, I try to read between the lines. We asked them a couple of questions, and also we did a couple of phone interviews where appropriate. But some of it's just, sometimes you just have to wing it and try your best. But we were, I feel like this was put out on social media, and a lot of our followers have similar values, or you're attracted to like, aren't you? So we've found some incredible employees that completely encapsulate our values and look like they'll be part of the team ongoing. Some of it was luck, some of it is definitely by intuition and reading a room and energy, I think.
Hmm. I feel like this is a good place to just to kind of take a step back, because, you know, the idea is so genius. Can you just talk us a little bit through what Lovely does and how it's different in the gift-giving world?
Sure. So we're a gift and flower, I guess at the heart of it, we're a flower business, but gifting in general. So we send out fresh flowers and gifts same day in Melbourne, Sydney and Adelaide, and next day nationally around Australia. We send it in these pretty cool specifically designed flower gift boxes where we can put, we're kind of known for our cheeky tone of voice and our flower jars. So we've purpose built these gift boxes that house a beautiful little jar with a label on it, which has some fun quotes that you can choose from. And then we put fresh flowers in them, and you can add on gifts like candle, chocolates, alcohol, things like that. And with a gift note, and we send it, if you order before 1 p.m, we can send it same day within Melbourne, Sydney and Adelaide, or next day across Australia. So I think we're different because we not only have flowers, we have gifts. we're different because we can genuinely say we can deliver it same day in some of the biggest populated cities in Australia. But not only that, we can get it to 95% of addresses in Australia by the next day. We're also different because we have, as I said before, this fun and vibrant, cheeky tone of voice that we don't take things too seriously. We also let you personalize things as you'd like to if you don't appreciate the way we necessarily word things. So you can personalize a jar, things like that. So I think we've kind of tapped into a kind of a market that really appreciates being able to, I guess, make their loved one's day any day of the week. So we're trading 7 days a week now. So that also sets us apart from a lot of other e-commerce florist business and gifting businesses.
And how did you come up with the idea? How did you spot this gap in the market?
It was Han and I met in Sydney about, well, it's quite a few years ago now, so I don't know, 8 or 9 years ago. We worked at Isobar together, and she's from the UK and I was from Melbourne, and so we're meeting in Sydney. We were both away from our home, our families, a lot of our close friends. And so that connection to be able to, like, you still had WhatsApp and things like that, and being able to find out how your friends were going and your family were going, but there was moments in those people's lives that you wish you'd been there for, or they'd had a bad day, or they got a promotion, or, you know, those moments where your friend has some children and they've been sick for a week and you just want to kind of reach out and send them something last minute that goes, you're a super mum, things like that. So we were both having those moments in our lives where we're like, there's just nothing that is kind of cool and fun, reasonably affordable, and can arrive there like within that moment of having those feelings, or, you know, that seems relevant. So that's when we started thinking about this gifting premise of, it's a beautiful premise to build a business on, is making people's day. Like, who wouldn't want to make someone's day? And that made a really heartfelt, I guess, start to a business model that we wanted to trial. So moved back to Melbourne and gave it a go.
And how long ago was that?
That was 5.5 years ago.
Okay. So you've gone in 5.5 years from essentially employees, so two founders, to now you're a team of 38, did you say? 36 new hires?
Well, we hired a lot. I mean, when I say we hired them over this peak period, a lot of them were contractors or casuals to help us through this peak. Settling back down into it, I think we've got about 15 employees plus a team of casual and contract, like pickpackers and florists, and we've also got contract drivers. So it's a big team if you add all them in, but I guess a core team of around 15.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't want to ask the question that never gets asked of men, which is, you know, how do you balance all of your priorities and you're being a founder? But I will say, you know, you've got two children, as you mentioned earlier, you know, starting a company and certainly a successful one, and seeing it through just the starting phases, let alone such a peak period of growth, is a challenge for anyone. So, you know, with all of those demands, what does caring for yourself look like in that context?
For me, caring for myself is balance. It's different for everyone, and that's what I've realized, is that for me, a balance, I hate the word balance in many respects, and this whole work-life balance, it's never sat well with me the way that people talk about it. For me, I am a balanced individual. I like a bit of everything, and it's also like I like doing a bit of everything at work. I don't know. For me, looking after myself is having uninterrupted time with family. I've always been like an outdoors and sporty person. So having that time to either go for a walk or do Pilates or anything else to myself, like a key moment in most days, is critical. And connection with, I have a lot of family and friends that aren't in Melbourne that I can't see, and being able to have that time to call them and connect and FaceTime and things like that. So they're kind of my me times, I guess, that I get fueled by, and everyone gets fueled by different things. But I definitely lost that a bit there for a few months there where it was very busy. And you can instantly tell the difference and the toll it takes on you and the burdens you feel each day, I guess. And it can instantly lift as well once you start getting it back. But that's how I try to balance as much as I can.
Hmm. So I know you started this together with a business partner, and I feel like a lot of the founder stories that I've heard, where there are, you know, one or more than one person involved, so whether that be at, you know, two or three or four at the beginning, some of them are, you know, we are an amazing team, we complement each other, and some of them are, wow, this was an utter disaster. And I guess there's probably everything in between there too, but yeah. Usually I either hear the, you know, this was amazing, or, oh my God, I can't believe I went into business with this person. How have you found the co-founder journey specifically?
Oh, there's the bumpy ride of starting a business in general. And then having a co-founder, I think, for me personally, it's been an incredibly rewarding journey. Of course, it's been really hard in some respects. We've had moments where we weren't sure it was the right thing to do this, because you hit those traction moments and those friction moments where you're like, you're both pulling in opposite directions, completely opposite directions, and you question, our values still aligned? Are we still moving in the same direction? But what I've realized about those moments and looking back on them now is they were critical for our growth. So we had to have had those moments of, at the time, they were emotional and overwhelming, and, you know, you have an array of feelings of doubting yourself and getting angry and a bit of resentment, but then coming full circle back around to acceptance of, you know, maybe ways you could do better and coming back together, and all of a sudden this explosion and you kind of move to the next level. And I kind of look back on those moments of being key defining moments. So having had Hannah and I are great business partners, I think we are very different in many ways, but we have very similar values. So at the end of the day, we're friends and we do have similar values to base everything off. It's not that we haven't had hard times, but I feel like they have really helped define the business journey for us. And yeah, I look at my brother, who's also an entrepreneur, and he is doing it solo. And there's so many moments where I go, I'm so glad that we did it the way we did it. Whilst they've been hard, I wouldn't have done it any other way in this particular business, for sure.
Hmm. So one of, I think, the most challenging things that I hear over and over again people struggle with co-founders, maybe particularly when they start out as friends, is how discussions around money are handled. Do you guys have an approach to how you approach, you know, whether it's sharing profit or your startup costs, that have helped you navigate that?
Yeah, I think we've had a pretty unique journey in that respect. We've always been very open about that trivial word money. It's a really tough one to have discussions around, but we had them pretty early because I decided to resign from Isobar and start this full time. We agreed that that was the right thing to do, that I should do that. And at the same time, Han was in Australia on a visa, so she had to remain employed at the time. So we decided it's better to get started than to put this off any longer. So I went into it full time from the back of my house, and Han contributed as much as she possibly could around working at the very start. She was working full time, and then she went back to part time, and then came into the business full time about a year later. But that time was really hard because, you know, Han was still earning a salary whilst, you know, in startup land, especially at the beginning, you don't know. You put in money to even just test your business model out and see if it's going to work. Like, you kind of don't expect to necessarily get a wage straight away. Like, we kind of knew that. Mm. But I was putting everything on the line, and she was still putting everything on the line in terms of she was all in, but, you know, for visa reasons, she had to still work at Isobar and still contribute to the business as much as she could. So, you know, after quite a few discussions, and, you know, they weren't comfortable discussions by any means, but we came to an agreement that worked for us, and it wouldn't work for lots of other people, and we understand that. But she was like, well, maybe it makes sense that we share my wage. Like, you're not getting paid in the business and I'm getting paid being out of the business. So if I'm working and earning money and you're helping to launch Lovely, why don't we share my wage that I'm receiving? And so she was completely transparent with me, and she shared her wage 50-50 with me because she was full-time out of the business and I was full-time in. And people are shocked at that, are just completely shocked at that.
I mean, that's the first time I've ever heard anything like that.
I know. Yeah. But to us, it seemed fair. It just seemed like, you know, if it could help with the momentum of the business, and momentum is key in any startup, then why not? And I really think that it wasn't a long time that we did that. It was, you know, 9 months or something, but it really helped us, you know, get to the next level to where she could then join the business. And, you know, we've had times, or most of the time, not, we've put our salaries back into the business, so effectively not taking a salary, because we've put the growth of the business first and foremost. But yeah, at the beginning, that was a really different approach, I think, which sets us apart, which I think is pretty cool.
Do you think that, you know, starting, particularly as it was at the very beginning, sort of starting out with that level of trust in one another to do that, has been part of the success of your relationship going, like, you know, for the last 5.5 years?
I think so. I think, if you can do that straight up, you've kind of gotten rid of a lot of the elephants in the room. You know, there's nothing too awkward to talk about after that. There's still lots of moments we've had, you know, we've, lots of things have changed. We've both had families, and our views on life and future, you know, everyone's changes over the years. But I think breaking the ice like that in the first year really helped us get a really good springboard for the rest of the business journey.
And in, you know, as you've run the business together now, how have you decided on when and how you should pay yourselves?
Yeah, it's been really tricky. It's always based on, you know, it's hard with co-founders. There's two of you, and we're spending all our time trying to create value within a business. So whilst we have a production heavy business, so, you know, 7 days a week, we need pick packers and, you know, coordinators of all that stuff and logistics and lots of moving parts within this production. So we have to have staff to do those jobs to create space for us to grow the business. And that's where it's, we've had those moments where, you know, we've started to like break even and try and create a bit of room for us to take the salaries, and we've taken them for a bit and then decided that that cash flow is better used to create, you know, or spend in a tech project that will, you know, help us solve lots of efficiencies in the business and things like that. So it's been really tricky. We've been really lucky to have supported partners that were able to support us financially as well. But, you know, it's still a really big juggle. We have to often, like, we have board meetings quarterly, and we have to continually bring this up, whether it's something we can afford to do ongoing, whether we reinvest that money into something else. It's a tricky jigsaw puzzle that it's a really hard one to have, really, to know that you're not getting a steady income that's just being paid by an employer, that you have to make that decision for the best interests of your future, to build the most value into a business as quickly as possible to then potentially one day sell it or something like that and get, I guess, get the payout then.
Mm. So I want to ask a question about particularly the financial, but not only the financial support you've just referenced that you both have from your partners. And the reason for that is I feel like a lot of times when we're interviewing successful people, particularly successful entrepreneurs, but, you know, really just our stories of success that we hear around, we don't actually see everything else that person might have had that helped them get to where they are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we judge ourselves because we can't achieve that same thing, but actually without the full story of all the advantages they might have had. Do you think that you would have been able to make Lovely the success that it's been if you both hadn't have had that financial and, I guess, for lack of a better word, administrative, in terms of family administration support from your partners?
I believe we could have made it successful because of we're driven females. But I think it would have just taken shape a different way. I think we potentially wouldn't have bootstrapped it, and we would have gotten investors in pretty early. And that just means that you dilute your shareholding within a company. So I think it would have taken a completely different shape. It could have even gone a completely different way on a trajectory that, you know, we don't know where it could have gone. But I still think it would have happened. I think it would have been potentially a different outcome, and potentially grown at a different rate. You don't know, I guess. But I think I've had my husband or partner at the time, he was earning a wage, and we just agreed from the outset that, you know, we could make it work on one wage for a certain amount of time. And then I also was lucky enough to have some savings that I could, well, I always wanted to start a business. So I put them into this business, basically. So I don't have any of that left. So it will be interesting to see how far we can now get. And we've always thought we might have to get investment, but we've been lucky enough to bootstrap it to date. So it's a really hard question. I don't know, but I don't think we would have had the space to realize our dreams, because, you know, pressure and stress of financial situations can really impact the direction of a business and whether, you know, you wrap up quickly or not. So we've been lucky enough, or I guess fortunate enough, to have the space to dream a bit.
Hmm. So as we're recording this, we are in the second week of Black Lives Matter protests in the States and now globally. And I'm obviously watching this with you know, a completely broken heart and very keen interest, because I'm American, but also because I'm, you know, human. And I don't know to what extent you guys are getting the news over in Australia of the protests, or if there are any that have happened there. But it's certainly given me pause. You know, I'm taking a lot of time now to reflect and thinking about what privilege I may have had in my own life that I might not even been aware of. And it's not that I've never thought about these issues before, but like anything, it's just become, you know, very acute and, you know, very present right now. So just, you know, with that in mind and our kind of all thinking about diversity right now, you know, what do you think in terms of, you know, what is one kind of unearned privilege or unfair advantage you've had that you think has been most instrumental to your success?
I would say that it is, my dad was and is a massive influence in my life. He started a business off his own bat pretty early on and was very successful. He ran aid projects in third world countries, and he instilled in me a lot of drive to do the same. And he was also very fortunate from all his hard work to be financially blessed. So I guess I grew up, you know, getting a private school education and I got a scholarship for university and just being kind of driven by, you know, having seen his experience. So I feel fortunate and privileged to have gone through that experience of a childhood, and also to dream big. I never held back on that. Mum and Dad have helped me a little bit financially, and they've definitely, I guess, gave me a little bit that I've had, you know, instilled in me good values in terms of financial success. I haven't just been given money. I've had to pay it back, but I've had good, you know, not had to pay interest and stuff like that, but I've been able to. I got into the housing market earlier than I thought I would because I could then have a loan to pay back without interest to them. So little things like that, I am completely aware of how privileged I am to have had that experience and, you know, to then have a house that with a mortgage, but, you know, it's not as much as a lot of people are paying in rent potentially. I'm not sure. Lots of those little things, you know, I guess add up to feeling very fortunate for the way I was brought up and the education I received and the friends I met and the travel I've had and the experiences I've had to have met such a diverse range of people and to dream big, I think, and to know that it's possible. I think I feel so grateful to have been able to live that out in this business, especially. I honestly wake up and love going to work, and not a day goes by that I don't. It's not lost on me. It really isn't.
Okay. Well, I'd like to end on a few kind of quickish fire questions. They don't need to be, the answers don't need to be quick, but kind of get through the list. Because I like to ask these questions because I feel like there's a lot of things that we might talk about one-on-one, but we would be, you know, much better off if we talked about some of this stuff more publicly. So first question, what's one lesson you learned the hard way?
I think probably health and safety at work, like in a production retail environment. It's not that anything bad happened, but I think that I took for granted, you know, I was very used to a digital agency where I was behind a desk and a computer all of the time meeting clients. And then you move to a messy business, floristry, pick packing, boxes, lots of stuff everywhere, pallets, pallet jacks, walkie stackies, all these things. I kind of probably learnt the hard way that I didn't take it seriously enough, that health and safety and work safe and all that is so integral to running a business like ours. And it's become a main focus for us that we is so important to keep our staff safe every day, just those little things that I never really had thought about before.
Mm. What's an opinion you once held strongly that you since changed your mind about?
Not sure. Might have to pass on that one, or maybe come back. I'll have a think. That's a really good question.
The reason I ask it is because I feel like in this social media driven world where everybody has an opinion about everything, it's somehow become wrong to ever admit you were wrong about something. You know, it's just, I'm sure that's always hard for human beings to do, but it feels like it's harder now than ever because people kind of, you know, jump on you. And so we feels to me like we're all holding our opinions so, so close, and it's just making us less and less open to new ideas, new information, new, you know, perspectives that could change our mind.
Especially with social media, I think you're exactly right. I do, you know, hold back on potentially using it like other people use it with and giving out opinions. I am not one to hold back, but I do it more in my, like, in person. I'm definitely a person to, like, I like feeling people's energy and reading situations and enjoying the physical energy of being around someone. So I think I don't hold back in that respect, and I don't necessarily hold my opinions back, but I definitely, in the digital space, I probably am a bit more wary.
Yeah. I think I'd like to actually delete my Facebook account, I think. it's difficult because, I mean, you know, and your business touches upon this so well, but my family is in the States, and a little bit, in Europe, but they're far away. I have a young son. So all the things that make Facebook great, and, you know, sharing pictures and knowing that, you know, my extended family can just see pictures and I don't have to send each one an email every day because who's got the time? And it can lead to those feelings of connection, but it does feel like it's just being used, you know, to further polarize us. And you're absolutely right. I mean, in this particular moment in time, I've seen that maybe more than ever. I mean, it was very, very bad during the last election that we had in the States, but it feels worse now. And there's so much false things that are spread on it. And yet I'm like, well, this is where the conversation's happening. I haven't quite worked out my thinking about it, but minds aren't changing. And I actually lay awake at night thinking, how do we change minds? What's one thing feminism has gotten wrong?
I think it's like all these messages is that they start becoming a little bit too, I don't know what the word is. It becomes so focused on that it's almost like it's not for the right cause. So for example, like, you know, a lot of companies have started saying we need more female designers or female developers in digital, for example. And so they go out and try and reach a quota of 40% of females in these jobs, which is great. I think, you know, more females anyway is amazing. But I feel like sometimes it all just feels like it's like a bit stoic, staid, and like trying to reach quotas rather than for the right reason and based off the right people for the job. And it all almost feels like you win a trophy but don't really deserve it, kind of thing. Like giving every child, you know, a medal or an award for being part of it. In some respect, it's a hard one. It's kind of like it's going in the right direction, but is it completely right? I feel like that I'm all for everything feminism. I didn't actually realize I was such a feminist person, but I feel like is going a little bit in the wrong, or maybe just feels a bit company corporate for me. It's not that it's wrong. It's just what happens when companies get a hold of this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think that one thing that is a disservice to almost any cause is when the conversation lacks nuance. And so these, you know, blanket quotas, for example, are really challenging because they don't recognize the nuance of the situation. And we've seen that in the States with quotas in universities that, which I think are potentially the right thing to do even, actually. I mean, they could be. I mean, it's worth having the conversation. Certainly they've had some good, but also if you just bring in people, you know, you accept people into university from super low socioeconomic backgrounds, which is oftentimes what it's driven by. So, and there will always be elements of other things in that, race and gender and what have you. But, and then you just throw them into Harvard and you don't have a really good program to of support around that person to get them up to speed with their peers who have had every advantage and private tutors and, you know, every resource they would have needed to, you know, be able to perform at a top level, but also, you know, fit in and, you know, all of those things, then you're actually, you can be setting that person up to fail. And that conversation about what we sort of need, whether it's gender diversity in companies, et cetera, it just requires a lot of thought and nuance and not always a blunt instrument, which, you know, again, sometimes doesn't feel like we have space for.
Perfectly put. That's exactly what you said.
Okay, great. Well, then now that we solved that problem. well done. Have a glass of wine. What's something women don't talk enough about?
This is one of our values. We say own your impact, and it is owning what you bring to the table. We don't talk about what we're strong at, what we're good at. We don't, you know, we're not confident often to have conversations around salaries we deserve and what we bring to the table in order to get that salary. I think it's a lot of that, and probably sex. To put it bluntly.
Yes. So moving, picking the first one up, and I'm happy to talk about sex too, but on the salary point, negotiating, you know, obviously you would have been in a position to negotiate for your own salary. And now I imagine you are in a position where people are negotiating with you for their salaries. So how do you encourage your team to come to you and ask for more when they deserve it?
It's really hard. It's really tricky. We have a performance review, an annual review process that we're refining ongoing. As part of that, a lot of reflective questions and that we all talk about together. But we also try to be completely transparent about reaching certain KPIs, like so that you have your soft targets and kind of, I guess, your more finite, you know, harder targets, or that we want to put within all of our goals. And we try to be as transparent as we can about what your results or your performance over the year could mean, so that it's not just a blank. And I guess that expectation exchange is had very early, so that, you know, there's not much, you know, we do want them to negotiate because we always want fight. And it's really tricky taking it from this side because we also want to drive a business that is sustainable and profitable. And so it's a really tricky one coming from the other side, because I guess we instill it naturally anyway, because we try to hire fighters, like people that have, you know, they hustle. So I think it kind of comes with the territory anyway. But we do leave some moments within our performance review for them to have that chance to state their case, I guess.
What are you still insecure about?
Probably still in, like, it's funny, like I think I'm really good at what I do, but on the other hand, I worry that other people like think or believe I'm as good as what I think I am. And that's not a, like a, it's an ego thing, I guess, but I also, you know, we have an advisory board made up of quite some, you know, successful people, and I'm insecure sometimes about what they think about my, about how I approach things. But I have to let it go sometimes because they're part of, they're part of our advisory board and they're there for a reason. So I'm a lot better at breaking that down, but I still am insecure about my strengths, which is hilarious because we should be just owning it and celebrating it. And that's what we try to, you know, hire by and instill in our team and things like that. But, you know, the human element creeps in, doesn't it?
I actually think that's a perfect segue then into my last question, which is, what are you really fucking good at?
I am really good at two things. One is people. I think I'm really good at understanding energy, understanding movement of energy within teams and feelings. And this sounds all very wishy-washy, but I can see it from a mile away when things aren't going to go necessarily in the right direction. And I can quickly pivot and kind of buffer the team in the right way to kind of create the right momentum. I'm really good at understanding when someone isn't feeling great about something. I read it instantly and I'm ahead of the game. I'm great at team building, team camaraderie, culture, things like that. And the other thing I've learned I'm really good at is coloring in. I've got a 4-year-old girl and we do a lot of coloring in together and I'm really good at it. So to have the other side of things, I can shade like a mastermind. I even have kept some of the things I've colored in going, wow, I'm pretty damn good at that.
Do you find it really calming, like some people do?
I love it. I never thought, I saw this whole like coloring in phase go through and I was like, whatever, as if. And now I can completely, we bought a printer during COVID and we've printed out lots of, you know, coloring in sheets and I have absolutely loved it. It's been such an outlet for me every night and a bonding time with my little girl. And I think I'm pretty damn good at it.
I think that is the perfect place to wrap up this vision of you coloring in with your little girl. We all need a bit of light and goodness in our lives right now.
Exactly. Thank
you so much for your time. If people want to learn more about you or about Lovely, where can they go?
They can go to our website, lovely, lvly.com.au, or our Instagram account, which is @hello_lovely. They're probably the two best places, or LinkedIn, and look me up.
Great. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you so much for your time.
I hope you enjoyed chatting with Verity as much as I did. If you want to hear more women tell it like it is, please subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. You should also check out the show notes for more info on Verity, Lovely, and to sign up for our mailing list so you never miss an update. If you've got a story and you want to tell it like it is, I'd love to hear from you. Do get in touch with me over at soapbox.org.